everyone. Welcome to Attorney Licensure and the Impaired Professional. I'm Tracy Kepler, and I'm excited for you all to be here. For the next hour, we are going to go through a journey of well-being. We're going to look at some surprising and maybe startling statistics around attorney well-being. We're going to talk about how to approach a colleague who you think may be impaired. We're also going to look at some model rules of professional conduct and some obligations to those rules when you are, caring for or looking at an impaired professional. And then finally, we're going to look at ways in which firms and you as individuals can contribute to your own well-being. So you know who you're spending the next hour with. As I said, my name is Tracy Kepler. I'm the Director of Risk Control Consulting here at CNA Insurance. But prior to coming to CNA, I had nearly 20 years of attorney regulatory experience, investigating and prosecuting attorneys for disciplinary rule violations, as well as serving as the Director of the American Bar Association's Center for Professional Responsibility. I've seen a lot of these issues firsthand, and it's been my goal, my passion, my desire to look at attorney well-being and how we can change the culture around it. What I'm going to do now is turn it over to my colleague, Lori Besden, to introduce herself and to really set the stage with her own personal story around these issues. Lori, take it away.
Thank you so much, Tracy, and we're so grateful that you're spending your time and taking this program today. We know how valuable time is. If the pandemic has taught us anything, it's certainly the value of time, non-renewable resource, and our greatest currency. So thank you so much for being here. Setting the stage, as I listened to Tracy give that fabulous introduction, I heard model rules of professional conduct, wellness, attorney licensure, impaired professional, and my own personal journey actually encompasses all of that, but not really in a good way until about 18 years ago. So we want to start off the program, and I want to share my personal story with you. And the reason I'm in the seat on the slide saying set the stage is this chair is available to anybody. I am the last person on the planet that I thought would ever professionally be presenting on a substance use disorder that almost killed me. I never would have believed this if somebody told me that, hey, read this book, this is actually going to be your life. Never in a million years would I have believed it. So I share this because at the end of the day, you know, substance use disorders, mental health, they don't discriminate, but neither does recovery. And it's important, as long as somebody is breathing, there is hope. And it's an equal opportunity offender. And it doesn't mean you're someone that lives under a bridge, which is what I thought growing up, you know, somebody who struggled with addiction was somebody like that. And my ignorance literally almost cost me my life. And luckily, it just ended up costing me my freedom, driver's license, law license, and everything in between. So I grew up in a suburb of Philadelphia in what I always often reference a two-story home, one story on the inside, one story on the outside. And it really mattered to my family what people thought about us and appearances and outcomes. Very education-focused family. Before my sister and I were even born, they knew we were going to be a lawyer and a doctor. They went to, you know, great lengths to have us. We were conceived through artificial insemination, which becomes relevant a little bit later. And so from the beginning, and I just say this because these are the facts, you know, I grew up, you know, with a house at the shore. I grew up, you know, overnight camps and cars when we were 16. We were handed everything to set the stage for success. And one of us followed that path directly. That was my sister. I kind of, you know, swerved a little bit, crashed a little bit. But the greatest thing is I'm alive to tell the story. And looking back, I actually would not change one thing because I would not have the credibility and experience that I have now and the ability to help other people if one thing in my past was changed. So again, like I mentioned, you know, people in recovery, we look back and we say, you know, I was just never really comfortable in my own skin. I was missing something. And so that kind of explains why some of us gravitate towards food, towards alcohol, towards substances, towards, you know, eating issues and gambling, whatever it may be. And so I started, you know, young age, I was introduced to nitrous at the dentist office. I loved the feeling. I just felt like it made me feel whole. And I was a kid. And the first time I had alcohol at age 12, ended up at the police station because I was roaming around the neighborhood drunk, half dressed. You know, and I kind of went through life and I was the kid that was always getting in trouble. So parents were like, oh, we don't really want our kid to hang out with her. You know, I was driving my parents' car before I was 16. It was one thing after another with me because I was trying to fill that void in my soul. And I did not know that everyone did not feel the same way. So, you know, I'm in high school. My sister is now in college. She is 3.5 years older than me. And, you know, she went to Penn State. I always felt like I was compared to her, but the truth is I probably was not. It was just my skewed perception. And so I decided to go to University of Maryland, and I loved college. Who doesn't love college? And, you know, to me, the only thing that my family indicated that they cared about were my grades. Every phone call, how are your grades? So I graduated 3.5 years with a 3.97. Fabulous. What could be wrong? Nothing. But I lived in a suite with 6 girls. My best friend and I, we would get a case of beer on Thursday nights. We would start drinking in the shower. And I honestly thought that was time management. And, you know, and I wasn't doing anything that anyone else was not. I was right in the realm of what Kathleen was doing. So I thought, well, there can't be a problem. I'm not the only person doing this. And my grades are fabulous. And so anytime that I drank, I blacked out. I threw up. I you know, woke up in places that I didn't know where I was. I never drank with dinner. That was never my story. And often people will say, you know, oh, I can't have an alcohol problem. I don't drink every day. I don't need to drink every day. It has nothing to do with frequency. It has to do with what happens when you drink is, you know, an alcohol use disorder and something to look at. So forward on, I graduate early. My drinking is completely out of control, but I didn't have any idea that was not what normal people did. And so then at this point, my sister's in medical school. I decide, you know, I wanted to go to cosmetology school, but my family was like, no, you're going to law school. So I had a semester off. I volunteered with a nonprofit. I still drank. And even when I would go out drinking with friends, I ended up getting alcohol and drinking in my house, in my bedroom, before I even went out, because I always felt like I needed something to level the playing field. So even though no one else even started drinking yet, I already felt like I was on the same level as them. And that should kind of explain like the hole in my soul. I just felt like I was less than all of my life, unless I had something in me that made me feel a different way. I go to law school, you know, and everyone's like, I want to be a trial attorney. I know what I want to do. And I'm like, I just want to cut hair. I was so lost. But again, you know, families funding all of this education. How are your grades? Top 15%. So, you know, and I enjoyed law school. I had 2 designated drinking nights. I went hard. I studied hard. And, you know, that was my law school experience. So 3rd year of law school, I'm in a car accident. And I was a passenger in the car. And ultimately, it was alcohol was involved. We went into the guardrail, end up at the emergency room, and I was prescribed Vicodin. That Vicodin lit a match. It caused a forest fire that almost killed me. Literally, you know, I went 100 miles an hour straight into an addiction that I thought I was immune from because of my Carfax and background. And so ultimately, I started going to emergency rooms in the area. I would bring my law books. I'm like, check me out, big law student with these big law books. And I would study in the emergency room. That's how long this ordeal took. And I found these pills gave me the ability to sit and focus and study. And what I realized later was I was treating an untreated ADHD. And so then ultimately I found a doctor that would prescribe these from Texas. I went from ER to taking the bar exam in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, taking 3 10-milligram pain pills an hour to get through those exams. Then, unfortunately, I had a clerkship on the Superior Court of Pennsylvania, and in the door with me went my addiction. I did pass both bar exams just because at this point, I needed those pills like people need oxygen. I didn't have a choice. If I wanted to get up and get out of bed, I literally needed to put pills in my body. I was so hopelessly dependent on the drugs, but I had no idea. I really thought I could stop at any point. And so ultimately, my doctor was my doctor. My doctor treating my 9 identities from Texas was suspended. And then I started, while I was on the Superior Court, calling in my own prescriptions. And I was taking 40 pills a day when the doctor got suspended. So I started calling in prescriptions for these narcotics from pharmacies from Philadelphia to Atlantic City, New Jersey. Ended up adding Ambien and Xanax to the mix. And I was not sober or, you know, dry for 1 minute until I ended up going to jail. After that clerkship, I had another clerkship, Philadelphia Municipal Court, and on that court, somebody as a friend of mine that I was getting together with from college met me and pulled out cocaine. And I say that today, I'm like, cocaine, I can't even believe that was such a big part of my life. It was. I tried that cocaine that day. I did not put it down until my freedom was taken from me. I don't remember the rest of that clerkship whatsoever. It was a mess. I was a mess. I lost a significant amount of weight. My mom thought I had an eating disorder, brought me to an eating disorder facility. They wouldn't accept me because they watched me, you know, eat and observe me. And my family went one way, I went another way. 2002 to 2004, I was no longer working. I did nothing with either law license. I was arrested 5 times. I had 29 car accidents, 3 incarcerations, 3 rehabilitation centers. January 29th, 2004 is my sobriety date. That was the day of my last arrest. On that day, a volunteer from the organization that I worked for showed up at the prison and said, you know, listen, I'm going to help you. And I'm like, who are you? You're an attorney. Are you representing me? Am I going to have to work for you? And he's like, this is just one attorney in recovery helping another attorney. It wasn't until I met Dave that I finally felt a bit of hope. He's the first person that shared what I thought was as strong of a life-changing disaster story as mine. And there he stood in front of me 31 years clean and sober, telling me he was going to help me. So that was the glimmer of hope when I finally met somebody that had my story that was a couple of steps in front of me. I ended up spending 11 and a half months incarcerated, ended up reporting everything to the disciplinary board in Pennsylvania and New Jersey when I was released from incarceration. Entered a 3-year joint petition for suspension in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Started working as a paralegal under the rules of professional conduct and worked in a firm, went to AA, went to NA, got a sponsor, home group, service position. Started bringing meetings, AA meetings back to the prison where I was an inmate. 2008, Dave insisted, let's try to file for reinstatement. And I'm like, I'm a convicted felon. Who is going to think this is a good idea? And he insisted, and we did it. And we filed for reinstatement. And in 2009, I was unanimously recommended to be reinstated to the practice of law in Pennsylvania by a power obviously much greater than myself. And then in 2010, I was reinstated to the practice of law in New Jersey. 2011, I came on board with LCL as the deputy director at the time. And why? Because I'm the product we sell. Oh, this LCL stuff, substance use, mental health, not me and my family. I almost died from my ignorance. And I am 100% the example of what can happen, but then what can happen because other people pay forward their experience. And now I wake up as a person in long-term recovery. I will do anything for anybody that needs help. Just a couple examples. So in 2017, I filed for a governor's pardon. And in 2020, that governor's pardon was actually granted. But the caveat to that is the Chief Justice on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Tom Saylor, at the time he was Chief Justice, wrote his first and only letter of support on behalf of my pardon application. He was on the Supreme Court for 24 years. I didn't know him before LCL. This is the redemption story. This is how our profession views redemption. The judge that sent me to jail stood by me at the podium the day of my hearing, literally stood with me. I get to volunteer with an animal rescue. I walk dogs every Saturday, 6 hours, rain, shine, holidays. And I adopted two pits, Amazing and Grace, and one Amazing volunteers with dementia residents, and I take it to the law schools with me. I've used these platforms to create presentations, breaking the stigma of substance use, mental health, and pit bulls. And I get to be a person in society. I tested and was approved to donate a kidney to a colleague in 2013. And I literally have presented multiple times with the folks that were disguised as a judge, a district attorney, FBI agent, all of these folks that actually arrested me, prosecuted me, who inevitably saved my life. I've gone on to present with them at Harvard. I've gone on to share our story for the American Bar Association. But this is not a story about me. This is a story about our entire system and what happens when one person cares enough to pay that forward to another person. So if there's any takeaways before I turn this back over to Tracy, I got reinstated in two states. So it's not just like Pennsylvania is lenient. Two different states indicated and felt that I should be reinstated to the practice of law in Pennsylvania as a convicted felon. I was still a convicted felon at the time. Then the governor of Pennsylvania fully supported and pardoned me. And if that doesn't explain, you know, how this society views, you know, second chances and redemption, then I don't know what possibly does. So there's a lot of hope in this story. This can happen to anybody, but so can recovery. And as folks in recovery, we have the opportunity to clean up the wreckage of our past. And that's exactly, you know, what I've done with everybody's help. So that is setting the stage for the program. At this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Tracy to talk about some of the statistics.
Thanks, Lori. And thank you for being so honest, so candid, and for sharing your story of hope and recovery. I hope it, and redemption. I really hope that it resonates with everyone listening to this program. As Lori said, we're going to continue on setting the stage, because I think knowing some of the statistics that have come out of recent studies is really important so we know where we are and we know where we need to go. There was a study in 2016 that really shook up the legal community with regard to what we thought about alcohol usage, problematic drinking, as well as some of the mental health data. It was a study, as I said, from the ABA, Hazelden Betty Ford, and it came out in 2016, studied 13,000 lawyers, practicing lawyers across the country, asked all kinds of questions. One of the things that really turned us upside down, we thought it was more seasoned practitioners who were suffering from these issues at greater amounts. But what we find, particularly with problematic alcohol usage, it is the younger professionals, those 30 and under, those who have been out of law school 10 years or less, that are 32% higher for problematic alcohol usage. The national average, the national statistic, is 6.4%. In addition, the survey reflected that 28% of all attorneys were suffering from some sort of depression, 23% stress and anxiety, 19% higher rates again among younger lawyers and judges. In addition, there's some new data out of the International Bar Association, which looks at well-being globally, not only individuals, but firms. And some of that data was really shocking in that, 82% of the firms say, yes, mental health is a priority. And we have well-being, programs in place. But the problem is, if you're looking at the slide, it's on slide five, that carrot gets smaller. It should be equal across the board. We shouldn't be seeing, only 16% actually have training for leadership, for supervisors, for managers. We shouldn't see only 27% actually collect well-being data to see what's happening, if it's making an impact. some other studies that have come out just within the past couple of years and really actually look at some of the COVID data that we've all been experiencing. ALM Intelligence and Law.com looked at mental health by the numbers. 74% responding that the profession has had a negative impact on their mental health. The same number feeling that their work environment actually contributes negatively to their well-being. And one of the most startling statistics out of their data was that 18% have actually contemplated suicide at some point in their careers. Questions were asked about vacation time. You know, are you resting? Are you relaxing? Are you reinvigorating? Only 36% used 100%. And then a lot of them felt stressed or uncomfortable when taking it, or were unable to turn off when they were actually on vacation. They were still doing work. Along the same lines, 62% reported knowing a colleague who is depressed, or having a colleague or knowing a colleague with an alcohol problem. Talking about mental health issues, the stigma is crushing. 77% said that they were really fearful about what their colleagues would think if they discussed their issues, if they discussed their concerns. And 65% said, you know what? I can't take extended leave. That's going to hurt my career. It's going to hurt my employment position. Bloomberg also did studies about satisfaction and well-being in the profession and how well-being has changed over the past quarter, significantly worsened. They also asked questions about what percent of the time did you experience burnout over the last quarter, and this was the first quarter of 2021. 50%! They said they faced all kinds of challenges, trouble disconnecting from work, increased tasks and responsibility, financial instability, trouble focusing, disrupted sleep. And lastly, there was another survey that just came out. It was from attorneys in California and the District of Columbia. It's called Stress Drink Leave. And it really looked at some gender-specific risk factors for mental health problems among licensed attorneys and showed that 1 in 4 women is actually thinking of leaving the profession due to poor life-work integration. So Lori, I'm going to turn it back over to you to talk about what is it about attorneys? What is it about legal professions that, you know, indicate a higher risk of mental health and substance use disorders?
Thank you so much, Tracy. And thank you so much for sharing those statistics. Truly eye-opening. It's kind of like I say this often, you know, there's an illusion, the stigma is an illusion with substance use mental health, and it is costing us lives because in our profession, you know, I'm an attorney, you're an attorney, and we think, you know, listen, people come to us to solve problems. Well, what happens when the problem is ours? Oh, we think we can solve it on our own. That's exactly what happens. So why is it so hard for legal professionals to ask for help? Because people ask us for help. So we have the answers. So of course, if it's going to be our issue, we think we can solve it. Well, as I'm the analogy, which I say this, I know it's in the PowerPoint, just like diabetes, just like cancer, substance use and mental health are medical diagnoses that require treatment. Prognosis is excellent if treatment is sought. However, have you ever heard somebody who was diagnosed with cancer say, I think I'm going to think my way out of it. I'm going to give it some time. I'm sure it'll just go away. No, people go to an oncologist. They get a treatment plan. People rally around them and celebrate when they get into remission. But when it's substance use and mental health, we're like, you know what? Maybe it's fine. It's just situational. It's a pandemic. No, we know when we're not feeling well. And there's so much strength in asking for help. But because of our exactly how we're trained in law school, and we're very like win lose and that mentality, it is so hard for us to ask for help. How many attorneys do you or anybody on this program know that literally love to ask people for help? I won't even ask someone to help me carry shopping bags into my house. So asking for help for a substance use or mental health challenge is really, really difficult. The skills that make us very successful in practice and in the profession actually work against us when we need to ask for help. We're so used to, you know, perfectionism. That's a huge issue in our profession, and relying on ourselves. So, you know, also, how many attorneys do you know, or anyone on this program know, that you would say have a really good balance of work and, you know, work-life balance? Personally speaking, I don't know many. I really don't know many. And I know that, you know, the more hours that we work in the profession, the greater our chances of developing, or our risks for developing, a substance use disorder are. And look at these statistics in the PowerPoint. 67% of attorneys and judges work more than 40 hours a week. So majority of our profession is working more. And the divorce rate in our profession is also higher than the general population. So I think there's a correlation. You know, it's hard for us to compartmentalize and turn our attorney hats off when we're with family. And sometimes that has a negative impact. I want to talk briefly about the conspiracy of silence. Often, you know, when I receive calls for LCL, I will have folks say to me, you know, I really didn't want to like call and turn somebody in or call about somebody. And so, first of all the lawyers' assistance programs are lifelines. We are not discipline. We are not, you know, no, you're not turning anybody in when people call the lawyers' assistance program. But often, people think like, it's not my business. You know, maybe they're just going through a stressful time. What I can say to that.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is DRY, D-R-Y, all lowercase, DRY. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is DRY, D-R-Y, all lowercase, DRY. Please take a moment and write this down.
Is trust your gut. If you feel like a red flag is up, you know someone well, you can tell they've kind of been off, don't ignore that. You may be the only person with the courage to say something and be a lifeline to that person. What I can tell you from my own experience, when I was struggling, okay, A, I was the last person to get the memo that I was struggling. I thought I was A-okay and doing just fine in spite of being arrested a million times. But I needed other people to see my reality. I was not capable of seeing what was going on. There was no way I was even capable of picking up a phone that was 5,000 pounds and asking for help. It wouldn't even have been possible. So oftentimes we're in a self-regulating profession. Don't be silent when your flag is going up that somebody might be struggling. We have a human obligation to help each other. So in the rooms of recovery, and this is on, you know, the additional slide, I think it says slide 15. My eyesight is not fabulous. Denial. So often, and in the rooms of recovery, we say that denial stands for don't even know I am lying. Again, every time I get arrested, no, I'm going to address this. It's not really a problem. You know, I did not even realize that what I was saying was a lie. I had no idea. So usually we are our worst enemy when it comes to that. We can think our way out of any reason to ask for help. And like I said, you know, I absolutely believed I had everything under control. I understand the statistics of all of my arrests and everything would indicate to any rational person there was obviously a problem. But to me, I thought, hey, I'm still showing up to a job. Hey, I get up every day. And to me, you know, that's all I saw. And, you know, it wasn't until honestly I was incarcerated for the last time. The first couple of times I was incarcerated, I thought, oh, I'm not like these people. The first thing I was saying when I walked in the door, I'm an attorney. Yeah, I'm an attorney. Yeah, how about you're also an addict? You know what I mean? And so I literally did the I have uniquers on. I can't be that. But finally, the last time when I was there, I don't want to say I embraced my inmate number, but I was exactly where I was supposed to be. I was no different than the person in the cell with me. I had things to learn from every single person there. And I was exactly like everybody else that was in the same situation as me. So it's important to realize that, you know, the internal battle is always denying the reality of what's going on. So at this point, I want to turn the program back over to you, Tracy, to talk about attorney impairment and some statistics here.
Thanks, Lori. I always like to bring in, you know, the connection between, we always say, you know, discipline does not make an attorney well. A disciplinary sanction doesn't get someone to treatment, doesn't get someone to understand or identify that there may be an issue, but keeping track of some of the data gives us a little heads up. And in the materials, you can see some of that data that has been collected by in Illinois around attorney impairment and the types of impairments that are either that are indicated in a disciplinary matter by the respondent, by the attorney, him or themselves. All kinds of things. You know, it could be substances, it could be mental health, whatever the case is, it's there. And in fact, studies show that 25 to 30% of lawyers facing disciplinary charges do suffer from some type of addiction or mental health issue. I would think that those numbers are even higher because of the rate of attorneys who default, who do not participate in the process at all for whatever reason, who are out there suffering in silence and may need help. When untreated, the lawyer's capacity to practice is almost always impacted. And lawyers who don't address it, or the people around them who don't raise it, talk about that they have concerns and they care. It really does harm the judicial system. It destroys careers, but more importantly, it destroys lives. But Lori, what are some of the things we can do? What are some of the signs that we can recognize in ourselves and others? And how does somebody approach a lawyer, you know, where they suspect there's something wrong, something's not quite right, and have that conversation?
Thank you so much for posing that question. And it is so important because we all have opportunities to help other people. So if you are concerned about someone, we will talk a little in more detail about what the lawyer's assistance programs are and what we do. But it's important that you know the lawyer's assistance programs are sounding boards. If you are concerned about somebody, we can help you navigate a conversation and get to where you need to get. And I will also say, if you're concerned about somebody and you can't be involved in approaching them, such as you're a judge and they're an attorney in front of you on a case, if you call the lawyer's assistance programs, we have a magical way of reaching people that need to hear from us. So I'll just leave that at that. What you need to do when you're thinking this is, again, trust your gut, you know, and you know each person has a different baseline. So if you know someone's personality is outrageous or intense, I'm often called intense. I call it passionate. People call it intense. But if you notice, you know, a change from that baseline, and you notice, you know, behaviors that may be off, or they're missing obligations that they normally don't miss, don't ignore those signs, you know. And you think, often we think, well, what if I'm wrong? And what do I say to you? What if you're right and you're the person that saved a life? Usually about a third of all calls to the lawyer's assistance programs are third parties concerned about somebody else. And that they're calling on behalf of someone that's not capable of picking up a phone and asking for them for help. So our overall approach is to be very educated in what you're doing. If you are going to be the person to approach the person you're concerned about, and again, lawyers' assistance programs can guide you on these conversations. They can be involved. This is always what we recommend. While the intervention show is fabulous and entertaining, In real life, sitting around a table or a room with nine people reading bottom line letters, Johnson style interventions, does not yield positive results. When you're the person, the subject of the intervention, all you can think is, how can I end this meeting and get out of here? You aren't even able to listen to the concerns that are being said because you, as a person who's struggling, you're feeling there's a conspiracy against you and you want to get out. I know that from experience. Always best to have one person that the person who is impaired really respects. One-on-one conversation always yields the best results. We recommend, you know, assuming it's a colleague, you approach that person and you say, you know, hey, I'd like to have a few minutes of your time. Is that okay? In person is always best. Have your resources lined up. Having a conversation and saying, you know, hey, we've worked together. You know, I've watched you coach, you know, your son's baseball. And you're really inspirational, just how much time you devote to your family and how much you care. But lately, I've just noticed, you know, it seems like something may be going on, you know, and it is so important not to diagnose. Even if you smell alcohol, don't assume. Half the time people are consuming alcohol to treat major mental health issues. So whether you, you know, and do not laundry list and say, this is what I noticed, this is what I saw. No, your language is everything. It appears something may be going on. And then you say, and I just wanted to let you know that there is a resource available, whether it's the Lawyers Assistance Program, whether you know this person has just lost a child and you have grief counseling meetings and information in hand to give them. And you give them the solution. And at the end of that conversation, you just look them in the eye and you say, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, I just care. There's no way to get that wrong, you know, but it's so important because often when people are struggling, we feel that people don't see us. And so it's really important for somebody to say, you know, hey, I want you to know, like, I see you, I care. And the fact that you care enough to get resources together and sit down and have a conversation can literally mean the difference between life and death to somebody. So please have the courage to engage in a conversation if you're concerned about somebody. So at this point, I'm going to turn the program back to you, Tracy, to give us some information on the model rules of professional conduct.
Great. Thanks, Lori. You know, we looking at the model rules of professional conduct, there are a lot of indicators where they direct us to do something about impairments. And maybe not even impairments, maybe proactively do something about well-being. And the place I like to start is really with the supervisors. And I'm talking about Model Rule of Professional Conduct 5.1. Supervisory lawyers have duties. Right? They have to make reasonable efforts to ensure that the firm has in fact measures giving reasonable assurance that everyone, all the lawyers, are conforming to the rules of professional conduct. That means, you know, with regards to competence, that they, you know, they with regards to termination, if there's an incapacity issue, with regard to making reports. And I think New Mexico has really struck a great balance in this regard by putting it right in the black letter law. They give New Mexico supervisory attorneys direct, you know, put tab A into slot B and what to do in these circumstances. You know, if you see impairments, what do? You can make a confidential report or otherwise seek assistance to the New Mexico LAP. If it's something, you know, you can report to disciplinary counsel. Maybe this person needs to transfer to disability inactive status for a little while. Or most importantly, and this should really be the first point in the rule and not the last, speaking with the lawyer and encouraging the lawyer to seek appropriate medical care and testing. I talked about reporting to discipline, and we all know that there is an obligation under 8.3A you know, to report professional misconduct, conduct that raises a substantial question as to the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. But please know that this rule and subsection C, and this is similar all across the country, does not require disclosure if the information is obviously otherwise protected by Rule 1.6, or it is information that is gained through a lawyer participation in a lawyer's assistance program. In addition, there are several ethics opinions, not only from the ABA, but around the country, that speak directly to the proactive nature of what supervisors can do. I mean, clearly the firm's paramount obligation is to protect the interests of its clients. But the DC legal ethics opinion 377, as well as the Virginia legal ethics opinion, really does talk about taking precautionary measures before misconduct occurs. Individually, you know, a lawyer has to provide competent representation, Rule 1.1, skill, knowledge, thoroughness, preparation, but also being well at its core. Mental, emotional, and physical wellness. In addition, we talked about Rule 1.16, termination, stopping representation, terminating, withdrawing, if there's a mental impairment that is materially affecting his, her, or their ability to represent the client. And as I said, one of the obligations, certainly not in the rules, but maybe it should be, is to think about treatment, to think about getting well, taking some other steps that you can do to help around wellness situations. A lot of the states are already changing the comment section to the rule in the competence place. You saw New Mexico's, Vermont, Virginia, California have actually changed their comments to have attorneys be mindful that mental, emotional, and physical ability can impact, can have a decision, an impact on the lawyer's ability to represent clients. And so, Lori, you know, we look at these rules and we look at the options for lawyers to refer someone to a LAP. What is a LAP? What is LCL? What is JCJ? What do you all do?
Thank you so much. We're like a, you know, Secret Service is really what we are. No, we're not the Secret Service. So lawyers and judges assistance programs are, every single state has a LAP. We call them LAPs, lawyers assistance program. In Pennsylvania, it's called Lawyers Concern for Lawyers, that, you know, some variation of that. You can get a list on the American Bar Association's website. If you literally type in LAPs and American Bar Association, a list of each state and contact information will come up. We are a confidential, safe, free, supportive resource for lawyers, judges, family members, and law students. Sometimes some of the LAPs do not, you know, extend to law students. Some may not extend to family members. But what I'm going to tell you, because you're listening to this program and because I'm Pennsylvania, if you or a family member are struggling and you do not want to call your state for whatever reason, you are free to call Pennsylvania and we will assist you and your family members. So just keep that in mind. So the resources that we offer, and again, we put up this slide, I think it's 34, just so you can get an idea of what are the services that we offer. LCL is so confidential, you don't even have to give your name if you call. And we're 24/7. We all know these problems and struggles are not 9-to-5. I'm not just a person in recovery 9-to-5. I would never make it back to the next 9-to-5 if that was the case. We all have websites with a myriad of information, COVID resources, resource guides, webinars that are free, incredible information. If you call and you say, I'm struggling with, a gambling disorder, we will actually, on Amazon, get you literature and have it sent directly to you. One of the most valuable services is we offer an evaluation with the healthcare provider. In Pennsylvania, we pay the initial session. Some of the other states do in-house and have therapists in-house. At the end of the day, every state has an option and a resource for you to speak to a professional, get a diagnosis, and their recommendation of treatment. And it's so important, if you're worried about somebody, you guide them towards the LAP, because nobody, especially attorneys, nobody likes to be told what is wrong with them. But when it comes from an independent healthcare provider, we may be able to hear it. So it's important that you guide people to the professionals and let the professionals make recommendations. Free assistance with interventions, we've already talked about that. If you're concerned about somebody, do not hesitate. Do not wait it out. We've had so many people say, I was going to call you, and in the interim, we lost a life. Do not wait. Time waits for nobody. Peer support, the Dave in my story, he showed up, you know, he was sober. And what was he doing? He was just being of service and paying that forward. I then was a volunteer for LCL before I came on board. And we can only keep what we can give away. It was life-changing for me to hear from somebody that walked my journey and was now living in the light. So it really is helpful if somebody's struggling to talk to somebody that's made it to the other side. We have recovery meetings, and you define what that means. Substance use, mental health. 13 of them throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Every state has some variation of groups, support groups, therapy groups, specific topic groups. 11 of Pennsylvania's are on Zoom. So regardless of where you are in the United States, You are free to join our Zoom meetings. And every LAP also has staff support. So if you need resources or you need to have information where there's a bed available, you know, at a rehab, in case this person becomes willing, you can contact the LAPs and they will do all the research for you and get you an email with all the information, including transportation. So when that small window of opportunity opens and somebody is willing to get help, that you have the information at your fingertips. Just wanted to briefly talk about trends. You can see on slide 35, you know, the trends that many of the lawyers assistance programs have seen and witnessed. Record-breaking years till 2020. You know, people were worried about where am I even getting my next meal from and not really able to focus on mental health or substance use. 2021 was a record-breaking year. 77% of all requests that we received were presenting with mental health challenges. Never in our history of 33 years have we ever witnessed anything like that. It makes sense though, the pandemic, stress, anxiety, grief. You can see some of the top presenting issues on the next slide. And again, you know, I'm gonna wrap my segment up here on slide 37. And I'm just going to put it out here. Like I said, you know, if you have cancer, you have diabetes, you go and get treatment. But when it's mental health and substance use, we struggle in silence because we think we should not feel this way. Well, so did Robin Williams. And the guy that had all of us laughing at the end of the day, life was too heavy for him. And we want to prevent that from happening. So when people think, maybe I can just wait it out. You know, I just want us all to remember what an amazing person Robin Williams was and, you know, use him as an inspiration of why it's so important to get help. So at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Tracy, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the firms can do to promote wellness and, you know, not attorney impairment.
Thanks, Lori. Yeah, with the remaining time that we have, we'd like to talk about, you know, what firms can do to improve well-being, to improve the culture of well-being in their environments. And then recognizing that there are a lot, you know, not everybody's in a firm. Maybe it's a solo practice or a small practice or a boutique practice. What each of us can do individually to improve well-being. So starting with the firm, you know, I look back to some of the data from the International Bar Association and some of the things that attorneys in firms are saying. What would help them? What might make a difference? And they say things like feedback, talking about culture, increasing levels of openness around well-being, cultural of mutual respect, a shared space where they can freely and without stigma and without implications talk about substance use disorders, mental health concerns. In addition, firms coming and putting in place some rules, policies, procedures around impairments, well, impairment policies and well-being templates, addressing the concerns, making sure that confidentiality where appropriate is in place, and then having all kinds of options. It doesn't mean that you're out of here. It means maybe you're taking a leave of absence. Maybe you need a referral to treatment. Maybe it's the workload itself. Maybe we need to look at the work that you're doing, the activity that you're engaged in, and switch you to a different department. It might be something remedial, and it might be, you know, maybe a conditional employment type of situation. In addition, you know, having a well-being committee or a well-being advocate on site that you can go to, that you can talk to, collaboration, right? Outreach, participating, cross-pollinization, working with lawyers assistance programs to, you know, make sure that you have education, training, a partnership on these issues. Isolation. And that has been such a problem during COVID when so many people were working remotely. But it was also a problem before COVID. And how many of us walked into our office, went into the office, closed the door, emailed people, and never actually physically got up and went to the office next to us to have a conversation. Combating social isolation and encouraging interconnectivity. Also monitoring for signs of work addiction and poor self-care. And keeping some stats on culture. I don't mean keeping biometric data, you know, your blood pressure or your heart rate, that kind of thing. What I mean is people who are, you know, getting in, are working 24/7, who are, you know, as you heard Lori say, there are changes from the baseline.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is SOB, S-O-B, all lowercase, SOB. Please take a moment to write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is SOB, S-O-B, all lowercase, SOB. Please take a moment to write this down.
Making sure that you notice and that you have something in place for those people. And so what can one person do, Lori? What can the individual do to work on their or to improve their well-being for themselves and for others around them?
Thank you so much, Tracy. It is so important that there are supportive policies in place at firms so people feel safe asking for help. So thank you so much for that information. So let's focus on wellness and, you know, what can we actually do to make everything that's on our plate, and most of us are type A personalities, manageable. And so often, you know, many of us create to-do lists that are absolutely ridiculous. Like, you create them knowing you're not going to be able to get to everything. And that is just literally setting yourself up for failure. How often do you create a to-do list and you actually put yourself on that list? And almost like a free period in school, and you can use that time however you want. Never. Us as type A people, we're so rigid and we have minutes and half hours planned out. And when something doesn't go according to plan, it kind of throws us off. So it's so important to prioritize your day. Make your list manageable, make it reasonable, and not set yourself up for failure. There are some quick, you know, stress busters that are certainly worth looking at. How many times, you know, and I say this often, when's the last time you turned your phone off for a hard reset when it wasn't broken? And people are like, why would I do that? Well, you go to sleep every night and do a hard reset to your body and you wake up refreshed. Wouldn't everything work better from a hard reset? But we never think of that. And everything is go, go, go. And, you know, it's so important. We take screen breaks, get off the screens, spend time with family. Harvard has an ongoing study, the Harvard Adult Development Study, started in 1938, follows people throughout their lives to ask them what is the most important thing at the end of your life. And folks say social connection and relationships. And the quality of those in your 50s determines how happy you'll be in your 80s. So instead of sitting on screens and thinking, I'm going to stop working for the day, oops, close my laptop, now I'm going to get on my phone and check email. What if you actually started setting the expectations of others based on your patterns of your behavior? When we respond to emails 24/7 within 8 seconds, that's what people start to expect from us. So it's creating them and letting people know, this is what I'm doing. Listen, first thing when you get on an airplane, the instructions, put your own oxygen mask on first in case of an emergency. Why? So then you can help the other people. Wellness is the exact same way. If you do not carve out the time for yourself, you are absolutely not going to be able to show up for clients, the firm, family, and all the million demands that are on all of us. This is not selfish. This is actually selfless. So turning off notifications is a fabulous one. In the materials or at some point, you know, there was a publication from Harvard saying, do not, you know, I picked up the publication and it said, buy an alarm clock as part of a wellness article. And I thought, I need Harvard to tell me to buy an alarm clock. And the article said, how many of us charge our phones almost literally touching our ear? And you wake up in the middle of the night, you want to know what time it is. You look at the phone and bam, all of a sudden you realize you missed this person's text. Oh my God, that email that you didn't respond to, somebody followed up about it. And there goes your sleep. The most important thing you can do is sleep. Literally sleep, that sets the entire stage for the entire day. Reading books and getting off of your devices. And certain apps, as we know, are not quite as healthy for us as other apps. So there are apps that make us happy, such as relaxation, exercise, weather, And then there are apps that we spend three times the amount of time on, such as social networking, gaming, entertainment. And what is the difference in those two apps? One has stopping cues and one does not. And being really mindful of where you're spending your time. So again, boundaries are so important. It took me, and again, I just speak from experience, 10 years working for LCL until I felt comfortable putting an away message on my email. 10 years, because I have created an expectation for not just myself, but other people that the second you email me 24/7, I'm going to respond. And it's just literally, you just cannot sustain that. So 10 years it took me, and I finally put an away message. Again, limiting your platform. Moving on to slide 50, meditation and prayer, huge way to get off screens, stop and focus. Meditation and mindfulness can be as simple as literally your foot touching the ground and you feeling the ground and being mindful of the impact and the touch that it's having. Exercise. I'm a Peloton person, and that is me on my tread. That is not a Peloton tread. That's my tread at work. But movement is medicine. And you don't have to be on a bike or a spin bike to get that. Go outside. Go for a walk. 10 minutes outside. Great impact on your mental health. Getting off screens. Go outside. Walk your dog without your phone. Go outside. Leave your phone behind. It's like we almost start to feel like we're naked if we're outside without a phone. But it's actually really liberating. Being mindful about your diet. On our staff, we have everyone take half-hour lunches. You are not to be on a screen at that time, and you are not to shovel your lunch in your mouth while you're staring at a screen. So just trying to be mindful, again, and just be aware of what you're doing. Also, gratitude journals. There's been a huge correlation between gratitude journals and wellness and happiness. Jotting down a few things that you are grateful for, a period of 10 weeks, increases your happiness and well-being 25%. That's Duke Law, which is incredible. There are so many more, you know, stress busters and great ways to beat out burnout. Again, Tracy had mentioned isolation. We're in an isolating profession, so it is so important to be mindful that you're around people. Remember the Harvard study. Connect with people. Make plans, plan experiences, and engage and enjoy time with family. This is the quality time with family slide 52. That's LCL Pennsylvania's, you know, families and staff. And it's important to, you know, take the time now. You know, we often say, you know, oh, I'll do it later. And we don't always have later. You know, and before I wrap up with one slide, I just want to put this out there as far as screens go. 2010, the iPad was introduced by Steve Jobs, obviously. 2014, Nick Bilton interviewed Steve Jobs for the New York Times and said to him, this is in a publication, yes, I bet your children love the iPad. And what did Steve Jobs say? Oh, my children have never used the iPad. We limit the technology that our children are exposed to. And so I just submit that to you. The folks that are smart enough to create the products actually know the truth behind them. Screens are not good for our mental health. So I want to wrap up the program. There are a few slides of resources that are very important and key takeaway points. The end of this program, what we want you to know is anybody is capable of struggling, but there are also solutions. There are resources. There are daily things that you can do to help yourself through this and also be your own advocate. We go to law school, we learn how to advocate for a mission or a passion. The most important person on the planet to advocate for is yourself. Don't forget that. The voice that we hear in our head that we talk to ourselves, that's the most important voice you're ever going to hear. We're going to wrap up slide 55, and this is the one more day slide. So many of us, you know, I happen to have pets. There are my dogs, Amazing and Grace. And so many of us, when somebody loses a pet, you hear them say, I wish I have one more day. I wish I have one more day. And this is what I would have done. And, you know, or family members also, you know, I was planning to see them and I ran out of time. I carved out an entire day with my dogs, knowing that one day I will wish I have one more day. And I did all of these activities. Maisie volunteered at memory care. We went to TJ Maxx. They had play dates. They had hamburgers. They had whipped cream. And I documented the entire day. And now I have this day and this slide. And what I want to tell you is you all do have one more day. And that is today. The time is now. Time waits for nobody. Do not wait to ask for help. Do not wait to make plans and spend time with family. Things that are important, including yourself, please make the time and make that a priority. Thank you so much for joining us for the program today, and we wish you well.
Thank you, everyone.